everybody, welcome to What a Hell of a Way to Die. You got Nate and Francis here today. Adrian is on his way back to the Ukraine, I assume. He was in America and he's heading back. He's heading to an airport. So I can only assume he's going back to war-torn
the land of borscht and shi and Russian people wearing fake uniforms.
Exactly. But that's okay, because Nate and I are still going to be here, and we're going to get you taken care of for this week. First thing that we are going to talk about, Nate sent me this article, and it is phenomenal. I think I posted about it on Twitter as well when I saw it.
Yeah, if you don't follow Adam Weinstein, you really should. He's a former Gawker writer. He's written all over the place. He's a Navy vet, served in Iraq, and he now writes for Task and Purpose, and is actually, I don't know if it's editorial oversight or he's found his niche, but he's been blowing it out of the park with stories in Task and Purpose. Like, he's been doing some pretty amazing journalism there. I strongly recommend you follow him and read his stories.
Yeah, he's one of the editors that I send my stuff to, and I really like him and Lauren Katzenberg. Yeah. So, and both of them, very good follows. But yeah, so Adam wrote this story about apparently there's a bill in Congress to start charging soldiers for their GI Bill.
So it's not been put out yet, but basically they're deliberating how to change the GI Bill and basically require a buy-in from soldiers.
Right.
Like, as if to say, instead of it being guaranteed as a result of your having served honorably and just being discharged honorably, I'm not going to say it's means testing, but it's a means of basically thinning the pool of eligible applicants by requiring a buy-in from soldiers.
Yeah, and I'm really wondering how exactly something like this works, because I joined when I was 18 years old and didn't start using the GI Bill until I was about 24, 25, I think, is when I started going to school. So it's, you know, either I have to have been paying $100 a month, which on a reserve pay, that means, like, you know, as a private, that means like maybe about a third of my base pay to possibly one day maybe use the GI Bill later. So there doesn't even seem to be any kind of guarantee of how this is going to work. Like, you know, is it $100 up until you start using it? But if you never use it, do you get that money back? Is that just a pool? And knowing the United States government and knowing the Army, I can go ahead and tell you right now that probably no. That's absolutely not what's going to happen. If something like this was to be implemented, you'd pay $100 a month. If you got out after 8 years and just never used it, guess what? You're never going to get that money back.
Yeah, because basically, so just understand the story, what they're describing is that there are a number of things they're trying to fix with the GI Bill. Specifically, there's an eligibility window that you have to use it within 15 years of separating from the military. You don't get benefits anymore. They don't always support things that involve online learning or distance learning, which can suck if you have a full-time job, like, you know, and you want to do like a low residency program for something. They aren't necessarily the best when it comes to, like, recently they haven't done anything to refund the money for people who went to ITT or Corinthian and basically have worthless degrees. So there's some fixes, but one of the things they're proposing, according to this article, is, and I'm going to read it from the text, the current draft bill would double the optional GI Bill buy-in for new enlistees to $2,400 in $100 a month increments starting in 2018. The idea is that you're going to basically require a young soldier who doesn't know what their, or Marine or airman or sailor, doesn't necessarily know what their future is going to look like, to make the decision that, like, oh yeah, down the road I'd like to have the government pay for my college, I think, maybe, or vocational school or something, who knows, art school, fucking learn how to make beats and Fruity Loops, but something along those lines. You're going to basically ask them to buy in. And that, to me, kind of raises a concern, because, I mean, there are lots of soldiers who's, like, as a society, we benefit when people come back from the military and are able to transition into the civilian workforce without necessarily going into debt or, you know, having to drastically lower their standard of living. That's why the GI Bill exists. So the idea that you're going to make an optional buy-in means that, so, and often, you know, I feel like you'd find cases where the people who would need it the most, who would benefit the most from it, who would probably raise the standard of stability the most in terms of, like, individual human, you know, individual effects, are the people who are probably not going to opt into it.
Yeah. So, and I don't know.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's not just something like this. I don't know if you're familiar with the with Strong Bonds or Yellow Ribbon. I think Yellow Ribbon is just for us part timers. But Strong
Yellow
Bonds,
Yellow Ribbon, I think, is actually for anybody who has 100% GI Bill. As I understand it, most schools, you are eligible for Yellow Ribbon if you're at 100%, which means you've done the equivalent of 36 months active duty. And it's basically, correct me if I'm wrong here, but Yellow Ribbon, as I understand it, is a stopgap that if you go to a school, like a private school that charges more than the maximum limit for tuition, if you're eligible and you get into that program, they cover the difference.
No. Yellow Ribbon, what I'm talking about, I don't know what you're talking about. Yellow Ribbon, and God knows,
so
maybe
many
it's
Yellow
changed.
Ribbons. So,
yeah, I know. Yellow Ribbon was a, it's a way that when you get done with your deployments, especially in the reserves, you know, there is no transition back to civilian society for us. Yellow Ribbon was supposed to be that. And it would be the first month, the second month, the third month, because when I come home from Iraq, I have 3 months before I have to start going back to drill again. Now,
gotcha.
I can opt to go back to drill like the day I get back, but generally they say, look, 3 months, take those 3 months. And what they did is they implemented Yellow Ribbon. Yellow Ribbon is great because it lets you go, you know, you get out of your city. If you're married, if you've got family, you can bring your wife, your husband, your kids and everything. And they put you up at a hotel. They pay you for the weekend. They give you your normal, a weekend pay. They pay for the hotel, pay for the flights or your mileage if you want to drive up there. It's great counseling and everything. And then they, you know, they do the stuff in the morning and they say, okay, take the afternoon to spend time with your family. They have another thing called Strong Bonds, which is basically that, but you don't have to have just come back from a deployment. So I've been talking about...
That's crazy, man.
Yeah, I've been talking about, you know, my wife and I wanted to do Strong Bonds because it's a great vacation. It's a good, like, little therapy session for couples and families and things like that. You get paid for it. It's, you know, it's a nice thing that the military has or had. I mean, it still exists, but anyway, it's just a great program.
So,
and I started looking into it and under my reserve command, there's no strong bonds for 2017 whatsoever. Not for singles, not for couples, not for families. And
so
there's nothing
on active. Okay. On active duty, those are all done through unit chaplain, and what you just described for the Yellow Ribbon, that doesn't exist at all. And that actually sounds like a really good idea, but it does not exist.
Right. The Yellow Ribbon, I think, like I said, is just for the part-timers when they come home. Because when you go home in your active duty, you get back from Iraq, you go back to your base, you've got all kinds of resources there. You can go to the unit.
In theory.
Right. There are better resources than there are for us who go back to Fort Couch, in theory. But Yellow Ribbon, I talked to my chaplain about it, and I said, look, I'm not finding anything. And he's like, yeah, you can't. It used to be you could go anywhere. Now it's got to be within 250-mile radius of your home of record, and you have to drive there. There's no flying anymore. And if there's not one for you under your command, sorry, you're kind of hosed. And there's not anything. And it's just – and I asked him about it. He's like, yeah, they cut it. I mean – and it always seems that when military budgets need to be cut, whenever a politician stands up and says, hey, we're spending too much here on military, it's never let's dismantle one of our aircraft carriers because we have more than 10 and the next most that a country has is one or two. It's always let's hose the soldiers. Let's give the soldiers a 1% raise this year. Let's, you know, cut back on things that might actually help them. That's how it's always
been. And something I point out, too, is that, yeah, and if you look at what we're talking about with the GI Bill, you're looking at this. These are relatively small budget line items. Like, the GI Bill is going to cost a lot over its lifetime because I think of the extent to which, I mean, it's very generous. But it's generous in a good way. I mean, it takes care of it. I know a number of soldiers who I serve with who've gotten out who the GI Bill, like, it was the difference between them being able to complete their, you know, vocational training or undergraduate education and basically having to work wage jobs for the rest of their lives. Because many of these guys were married and had kids. So, like, if they weren't getting that BAH from the basic allowance for housing from the GI Bill, that's the equivalent of, like, a full-time minimum wage or, like, you know, 10% above minimum wage job. I mean, in New York City, the BAH for GI Bill, regardless of what your rank was in the military, is pegged to the E5 rate for married service members. So in New York City, that's almost $4,000 a month tax-free when school's in session. So, like, that's so generous. I mean, it's unbelievable. And it's helpful. I mean, it's only for when you're in school. So, like, it's not as if people are going to just hang out and use it and, you know, like, sit on the couch and not go to class. Like, it's actually a great program. And it doesn't, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't cost that much. But then you look at what you've just described, you talk about these programs that affect individual soldiers or that are specifically designed for the reserve component. And I mean, not to barter in cliches, but it always does seem that the ones that involve, like, a community-based thing or a program that reaches out, like that helps people, but in, they employ civilians in the process. Like that's what gets cut. Or like when the daycare got cut in Germany, like all the Oconus daycares were basically hit by the federal hiring freeze. Like you see these things happening, and it's like that can't be the only way that you can achieve some sort of budget reduction. And obviously with the Trump administration, it doesn't even seem like budget reduction of DOD is a priority. But for some reason, it's like the same sort of refrain that you hear across the world, that the people who are connected enough to keep their lines of credit get all the money they want, and it's austerity for everybody else.
Yeah, there's never anything, you know, like I said, you can't cut back on warfighting machine itself. But when it comes to these smaller programs that people don't know about, like if we went through and we decommissioned the USS Enterprise, which is one of our aircraft carriers, there would be news stories about that all day. And people would have, we're weakening ourselves. Every asshole with a Twitter account or every asshole on Facebook would have some fucking opinion about this. But it's these little things that can quietly be defunded slowly and surely. And those are the ones that go away. And I'm not saying that this is Trump. This has been, because we've had forced reduction going on for years.
Since the sequester hit, it's been pretty stark, extent to which. I mean, yeah. I was in the Army. I was in my last 2 years in the Army when the sequester debate was happening. And then the sequester actually hit when I was in Korea. So we weren't affected. But I had friends back home that were talking about the level of training shutdown they were experiencing was insane. That it's been happening for a while. But it's not affecting the bottom line for defense contractors in DC. It's affecting, you know, things like what you've just described, morale, welfare organizations, recreational things like daycare, things like the benefits that not only affect the most economically vulnerable members of the military, but also are huge retention tools and provide a kind of ersatz middle class existence that is basically impossible otherwise.
Yeah,
like when you think about what we used to, I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to sound like an asshole, but my officer friends and I used to complain about sometimes you deal with really just like the difficulties with family members, people, you know, your soldiers' family members, and it's like you realize that the military basically provides a gateway into middle class life that America has basically eliminated for everybody else. Like if you're working poor or you're working class in America, the benefits you get in the military are completely inaccessible to you unless you work for the government or the military.
Yeah, as I tell people, there's no other place that an 18-year-old is going to get a paycheck every 2 weeks and 30 days paid vacation, like on day one.
Or even more than that, guaranteed housing or a guaranteed voucher for housing if housing is not available. And if you're 19 and married and have a kid, not only you don't have to live in the barracks, they literally like, no, here's money so you can rent a house or buy a house somewhere.
Yep.
Like, what job in America is going to do that? But you also have to go to war and get blown the fuck up and so on and so forth. So it's just...
Yeah, that is always the other side.
But it's strange because, like, okay, let's be perfectly honest. During the GWAT, you know, since 2001, like they've actually, in my opinion, from what I've seen, ramped up some of these benefits in order to use them as retention tools because they were cycling through people so badly. You know, like they were losing people after one hitch because, you know, you do 3 years in the Army, you do 9 months, or if you're an officer, I guess I'm trying to think for enlisted guys, it's what, like 6 months normally, unless you're in like a specialty MOS? Like the amount of time you spend in your one station unit training and then like any follow on stuff. It's relatively short, and then you're in a unit, and you're probably about to deploy. You're ramping up for a deployment cycle, and then you come back, and it's like, so guys, you know, they come in as 19, 20-year-olds, and they leave as 22, 23-year-olds, and the Army wants to keep them longer, so how do you do that? Well, it's like you provide these benefits, and if they get married, then their wives are like, no, you've got to re-enlist, because, you know, where else is a guy with, you know, a high school degree going to get, like you just described, guaranteed pay, guaranteed housing, guaranteed full comprehensive health insurance for their entire family, free, a thing that would pay for their college in the future, guaranteed housing on base. Like it's unreal. And so it's just so strange to see these cuts taking place, realizing that they're almost designed to affect the most vulnerable. It's like another sort of reinforcement of the idea. It's like, oh yeah, you guys are expendable. Like we don't really care about you. And I know that's a hyperbolic and uncharitable interpretation, but like if I were Private Bethay, I would be really worried about this kind of thing.
And we're not only seeing it there. I've been starting to see it. I've been seeing it for a while on the training side as well. there used to be, you used to really have good retention because at least like every, in the reserve side, when we do our annual training, you could normally get like every 2 or 3 years, get a pretty interesting annual training. Like, you know, you could go, I've been to Honduras, I've been to Germany, I've gotten to fly all over. I got to go to Japan in December, and that was kind of a friend of mine keyed me in on that, and I kind of snuck out the door to do an annual training and then came back and I was like, oh, I used up all my annual training days. But nowadays in the reserves, I don't know about all the other units, but I go to Fort McCoy, Wisconsin, which is shit, or I go to Fort Hunter Liggett, California, which is also shit.
Isn't it like right outside Fort Irwin, like in the middle of the desert?
No, it is actually, it's near where Fort Ord used to be. So
right on. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, basically they shut down Fort Ord and then moved moved slightly north. And
for our younger listeners, I actually grew up, I lived in Fort Ord for 3 years. There used to be an active duty army base, like with a brigade-sized element of combat soldiers, like an hour, south of San Francisco?
Oh, it's way more than that, because we had to fly, to get there, we fly into San Jose, and then we have to drive. It's like 20 miles away from the coast.
So it's a beautiful place. Like, so go figure, they had to close it down because it's an army base. Only the Navy's allowed to have nice locations.
They fucking closed it down because they shot so much lead into the side of the mountains out there that the ground is poisoned.
It's like a super fun site now.
Yeah.
The houses that I lived in as a 3-year-old, 4-year-old kid are used as a mount site, like a urban warfare training site now. Mm-hmm. I've known people that have gone through and literally like kicking through the old base housing, like doing door kicking exercises, you know, like room clearing and that kind of a thing. But anyway, not to get digress here. So right. You're saying that you've witnessed personally the AT training options getting worse, you know, in the last couple of years as far as like the kind of training they have funds for you to do.
Right. Because what they end up doing for us is the training now is, all right, go out, take a bunch of GP medium tents or GP large tents, set up tents, put down cots, take out your MKT, and do Army shit for 2 weeks. You know, do whatever it is that your Army unit does. And, like, on one hand, that's good training to take austere conditions and make a usable base out of it. But the last couple of times I've done annual training, that's all we've done. And I'm going to tell you something. I've never deployed somewhere and been in austere conditions in that kind of way. Like, I know there's a lot of forward operating bases that that don't have very much. But it was never, okay, we are just, here's the tent that you stay in. There's not even a floor or anything. There's just high grass and bugs all over the place. And I know I sound like a little pogue-ass bitch.
I was an infantryman, and you're right. I mean, I was an infantryman, and that's the kind of thing that we experienced when we trained. I went into an FTX in Alaska at Fort Greeley in the Donnelly training area. The first time I went, we stayed in tents the whole time. The second time I went, they had built hard stand, like barracks for us to stay in. Same thing, you know, you set up a mobile kitchen team, you had a, but like when I was deployed, you might have bases where like the shower conditions were iffy at best. Like some guys literally like didn't have showers. Sometimes I wonder like, is that really, I mean, that's just because it wasn't a priority for them to build one. Because I mean, like with a fuel, like a water blivet and some plywood and some piping, you can make a fucking shower if you want to. But all of the, even the most austere forward operating bases that I ever went to, oftentimes like they might have been that way when they first got in, you know, and they set up a perimeter and like dudes were sleeping in sleeping bags, but like they built shelters, you know, they got HESCO bastions and they filled them up with dirt and rock and they've made structures and they made plywood bee huts. And they, so it's like you did actually have that. I mean, not to go too far off the track here, but like I see what you're saying, that you find yourself forced into a kind of artificial state of austerity, whereas like when you do go down range, like the money is turned back on all of a sudden.
Yeah.
And then it's like,
those are just training conditions that, cause my unit is RSO and I, and I'm not 100% what that stands for, but basically if we deploy to Kuwait, and when people are coming in and leaving the country to go into Iraq, they swipe you in, they swipe you out. It's kind of a human resources group.
I want to say was it reception, staging, onward movement, and integration, I think is what it stands for.
That sounds,
but yeah, I know what you mean. Right. It's like the guys, you're basically that, you run the PAX terminal.
Yeah. So, we don't do this shit out in the field. And I feel like those kind of training instances take away from our morale.
They should have put you out there. So you guys, you have to make a field expedient ID card scanner. like with nothing but charms from your MRE packet and like a prism and a toothbrush, just put it together and be like, somehow it's going to work.
Goddamn, how long has it been since you've been in the Army? You think charms are still a thing?
I know charms don't exist anymore. if they were still in, I wouldn't mention their name because they're cursed.
Right.
It's just strange to think of that. I mean, in the same vein that it was strange to think of, we were doing training as an Arctic Light Infantry unit, you know, an airborne unit in Alaska, and, like, we were dragging fucking sleds full of equipment in the snow to set up and do, like, Arctic training. And, I mean, don't get me wrong, it's good to, like, train soldiers to prepare for, like, those kinds of conditions and do all the things you have to check in advance to make sure you're not leaving something behind that's going to get you killed. But at the same time, it's like, I assure you, I was not dragging a fucking sled in Alaska, or a correction, in Afghanistan.
Right.
Like, There were no sleds allowed.
Well, we'll see when we go to war with Russia what you're dragging around in the snow.
Yeah, well, I mean, on a positive note, we still have hundreds and hundreds of those sleds in containers somewhere in Alaska. So if they really need them with the Arctic stove and shit that you have to pack together, and like, God, I can't even tell you as a platoon leader how many times we had to do inventories of fucking Arctic stoves. Like, it's just, in a way, what you're describing is like the effect of policy that like briefs well at the very, very senior level, but by the time that it's executed down at like the individual unit level, has become this complete cluster where it's like, I mean, what kind of training do you guys get out of that AT? I mean, I'm not trying to like badger you to give me the most negative answer possible, but like, what kind of training do you actually get when, I mean, are you guys doing like ranges? Are you doing like sticks lanes? I mean, what is an RSO and I unit or a PAO unit doing out staying in GP mediums in the middle of nowhere?
Well, as a PA unit, I always like, because generally what we're doing is we're going to war games. Now, the RS and ONI, the last time I went out with them, it was, they were basically scanning people in and out to go to these other FOBs that were set up all over. We were at Hunter Lake at that time. And so, I mean, that was good training. It's like, this is how, when all these buses would come in, and we all work together to, you know, because we've got to do these in-briefings, and we got like 1,500 people on one day alone, and we had to do in-process briefings and everything. It was just rotating everybody through. That was really good training for that one day. And then we're doing sticks lanes, but for the
uninitiated, that's a situational tactical exercise.
Yes.
So it's basically like playing army in the woods. Like, the bad guys are there, and you have to pretend they're real, and you have blanks in your M4, your rifles and such, and you go out and do it like you do it in real life, but there's always a certain degree of fuckery involved because it's like real bullets aren't actually flying at you. So that and MRE candy is like a pillar of Army life.
Yeah, there's so we'd have like, you know, oh, there's quote unquote riot at the front gate. And so the way that we had our front gate set up, because we still had people driving in and out and everything, we had a concertina wire that somebody would be able to, you know, put the gloves and open the concertina wire. Concertina wire is the big, if you ever look at like the outside of a prison at the top of the fences.
It has razor blades on it.
Yeah, it's the razor, but it's the big coil. It's not just regular barbed wire. So we have that, so you can pull it open and close and everything. And then, you know, when the quote-unquote protesters come over, one of them, like, kicks it open, and they're all inside. It's like, oh, you know, the graders are there saying, well, you let them, you know, breach the perimeter. It's like, I've never, ever been to a entry control point that was set up like this overseas. Like, we wouldn't have this. We would have towers. We would have HESCO barriers. We would have a serpentine that somebody has to drive through.
It's always funny when they're like, you're not treating this seriously. It's like, well, yeah, because in real life, we'd all be dead right now because this is just a fucking thing of concertina wire dragged across the ground, and we're calling it an entry point.
Exactly. It's like, I'm working with the tools that you give me. Like, if you want to tell them, you know, the people that are pretending to be these protesters and these rioters, hey, you all need to treat this as if, like, this is a big serpentine thing. You need to treat it like it's a wall here. Then you need to do that. You cannot sit here and tell me that I'm doing bad here, because this is not how I would have this set up if I was in Iraq or Afghanistan or Syria or wherever. This is not the entry control point. And then we would have people like, oh, this person snuck in across your back perimeter. It's like, well, my back perimeter is like engineer tape. It's, you know, put between two posts that they, like, ducked under. Like, guess what?
I think that's the point, though. I mean, about what we're describing is that when you have austerity in the military, like, people still get fed, but the training that they do to learn their jobs and stay proficient at their jobs tends to suffer. And yes, you can invent things and make stuff out of thin air to train soldiers to occupy their time, but there comes a certain point at which nothing is going to substitute for actual hard training that has the correct kind of, you know, resources that you need. And I know Adrian might disagree with us if he were here, because he talks about how the oversupplied army tends to have shittier training. But I also think about, like, what you're just describing, and I think about, like, what would my soldiers do if we, like, didn't have blank ammo? I mean, it's very hard to communicate to somebody, like, how to do their job when they've never actually experienced what it's like to be shooting live rounds downrange and, you know, having to maneuver around it and deal with, like, the reality of that.
I'll tell you, you know what, when they give me blank ammo, I give it to the fucking private next to me, because I ain't cleaning my rifle after that shit.
Yes, so when you have a blank firing adapter on your rifle, it stops up all the carbon that might escape when you fire, because it needs to have the pressure so it can force the bolt back to chamber another round. Otherwise, the rifle would be like a musket, and you'd be pulling the fucking charging handle every single time you shot. So, but what that creates is, because you basically blocked up the tube to create that pressure that's adequate to throw the bolt back, firing blank rounds in an M4 or an M16 basically makes, like, it's like a candy cane of carbon inside that rifle. And so it's just, like, fucking disgusting to clean it out. Like, you could shoot an entire box, like, 3,600 rounds of 5.56 ammo, and it wouldn't be that big of a deal through a rifle, because, like, most of the carbon's going out. But when you fire, like, a magazine's worth of blank ammo through an M4, like, God, it's disgusting.
Oh, yeah. I'd always go try to find the gung-ho private or PFC, and be like, hey, man, they only gave us, like, 20 rounds of blank ammo. You want another thing here? I'll just run around and say, bang, bang, it's fine by me. And then, like, later on when they're scrubbing the shit out of the inside of the rifle, like, I'm going back to the armor. I'm done with this nonsense.
And that's the thing, is that you think when you join the army, like, oh my God, this is going to be some Full Metal Jacket ass shit all the time. And then you find yourself in the middle of the woods somewhere in Missouri or California or somewhere, like, and you're just yelling, bang, 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 bang. And there's a guy in the back who's supposed to be the M249. He's like, bah, bah, bang, bah, 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 bang. It's just like, wow, this is no different than when I was 11. It's just our uniforms kind of match.
Yeah, I had at one point during a sticks lane, we were being fired upon, and then we were firing back on the wood line, and one of the instructors came over to me and says, how are you going to hit a target? You got I had one of the red dot CCO scope on it. He said, how are you going to hit anything? You've got the covers on that. Like, they're blank, so I'm not going to hit anything. And we're not wearing Miles gear, so I'm especially not going to hit anything. I don't know, because I don't want to clean it. That's why. Same reason I'm not shooting my blank ammo right now and just yelling,
see, that's
bang,
the problem.
Bang.
That's the problem, Francis, is that you're looking at things the practical way, whereas, like, what they really want is the HUA way, which is, like, expending 10 times as much energy as is actually required. But, like, everybody's like, God damn, that guy really expends a lot of energy. He's a go-getter.
Yeah,
those people tend to not do well in combat.
Yeah, they want you to be, they want you to, in training, be like Willem Dafoe at the end of Platoon, just running out in the middle and then dropping to your knees.
So, speaking of badass combat that's not actually real, the military has apparently approved modifier devices for the Bronze Star Medal that would allow you to discriminate, basically to say, this person was in combat versus not in combat. But even more excitingly, there's a new device for the Bronze Star Medal, the R device, that makes it a remote combat, which is to suggest you can get a Bronze Star for being a badass drone operator in Las Vegas, Nevada.
You know, I think it's high time that the video games, that the gamers of the world finally got a Bronze Star. it is, you know, it's Gamergate's come a long way, and we finally made it, folks. Now,
so it used to be about ethics in gaming journalism, and now it's about ethics in the military award system.
It's about ethics and Bronze Stars.
Have these brave, plucky pilots been denied the third highest combat award in the U.S. Army from bullet-headed idiot leaders who are like, no, you didn't actually deploy to a combat zone. You were staying in Las Vegas the entire time shooting drones from your video game system. But now they're going to get awards.
Well, I wonder if this means that the artillery guys can get awards too. Like, if they can get a Bronze Star with, I mean, you're not going to get the combat device, but an artillery guy, not exactly, you know, frontline door kicker.
So I would say they should have an F device, which is, I actually fired my artillery piece in combat. And then the H device would be, I actually hit something. And Lord knows that would be the most coveted award in the artillery corps, because, like, I don't know about you, but on the times that I've either deployed or prepared for deployment, the artillery guys, like when we did our training rotations, we're doing call for fire, and then in actual real life deployment, they were basically like they operated the counter mortar systems, and like their job was working the propaganda radio stations because they literally had no job.
Yeah,
like,
and then not only you could have the H with a target over it for I actually hit my target.
Yeah, I hit just because you hit somebody, just because you hit something and killed it, doesn't mean it was what you were actually trying to hit. Case in point, I was in Korea, and one of our paladin units actually hit something. It wasn't their target. It was a Korean house. Mercifully, they were using TPT ammo and not actual high explosive ammo, because that would have been bad. But so this is a strange thing, because something that I feel doesn't get communicated to the civilian populace is that the military award system is very service specific, and it's not immune to political pressure any more than anything else in the modern day. And so, like, okay, I have a friend. I'm not going to name him. He's a decent guy. He's kind of an idiot. But he deployed to Afghanistan, infantry platoon leader, good guy, you know, did his thing, came back. We met again. We went to Special Forces selection together. We got selected, and then we had to go to the captain's career course at Fort Benning. So he shows up with his truck and a license plate that says Bronze Star winner. Now, here's the thing. Here's the thing, right? Does he have a Bronze Star? Yes, he does. So do I. They were our end of tour awards. We did a deployment in Afghanistan. We didn't fuck up too badly. We were officers. We had a pulse. So we got a Bronze Star. It's not a Bronze Star with valor. That V device is like you did something heroic. That's a different award. So when people in the civilian world think Bronze Star, they're like, holy fuck, like it wasn't cool. It wasn't Captain America enough to get a Silver Star, but it still must have been pretty badass, because otherwise you wouldn't have a Bronze Star. I mean, all I know about is star, and it's an award, and it's in the Army, so you must be a fucking war hero.
Yeah, but I have a feeling that too many people, too many officers, like too many majors probably, were getting Army Commendation Medals at the end of their deployments, and they're like, you know what? I sat at this desk like a goddamn American hero for 18 months. I'll be damned if you're just going to give me an ARCOM. So you need to give me a Bronze Star. And it just rolled. Because, yeah, every officer and every senior NCO.
Yeah, E7 and above typically gets it. And the guys who don't, like, if you see, like, I hate saying this, but unless their unit was just a fucking bunch of assholes, and if you see, like, a captain with, like, he's deployed and has, like, a CIB, but he only has, like, an Army Commendation Medal for that deployment, like, that's sort of, you know, subsurface Army speak for this guy's a fucking idiot. Don't trust him.
Yeah. Well, when I went on my last deployment, the first ID, my unit, the public affairs unit that I was with, put me in for a meritorious service medal. An MSM is basically the equivalent of a Bronze Star for us, you know, pogues and paper pushers. And I was really excited. It's like, oh, cool, an MSM. That'll be my highest award. It's, you know, yeah, like I said, not a Bronze Star. I don't want it to be a Bronze Star. I didn't do anything to earn a Bronze Star, but I did something that I feel I could have earned, meritorious service medal. Award comes back. First ID is like, we're not doing MSMs. Give everybody Bronze Stars. And my unit gave out Bronze Stars based on how long, you know, so it was all that they're like, we have 20 people. We have 10 Bronze Stars. All the officers, you know, we'll get one. Senior, you know, NCOICs will get one. And then we have to give one. They're like, we'll give one to the next highest NCOs. And I missed getting the Bronze Star by 6 months of time in service. And
yeah,
that's literally it.
I figured they would do it like time in grade or time in service. That totally makes sense, man. That sucks.
Yeah, my editor had been in the Army for 6 months longer than me. And, you know, and even he was just like, this is fucking stupid. Why would they give me this?
Dude, so I had a squad leader when I worked for the battalion commander's TAC. Basically, I helped him set up this unit where it was sort of the personnel security detachment for the battalion commander, but it was his tactical headquarters. And for about a month, you know, I helped him sort of set stuff up. He was great with managing soldiers, but not necessarily as experienced with planning missions. And so I was the headquarters company XO, and I helped him out. But like, he did all the work. I mean, like, I helped him build the graphics that would pass muster so that like people at the talk, like the command center, would look at it and be like, okay, I know this mission is acceptable, like you're not going to fuck up and die. But I mean, this guy was doing all the work. He was an E5, and he was operating like a platoon sergeant, like an E7. He was operating two ranks above his current grade. He was doing a fucking great job of it. Like, sadly, we don't really get along now because of politics, but like, one of the best NCOs I've ever met in my life, like, would gladly go to combat with him any day of the week. So I put him in for a Bronze Star. He deserved it. He was operating in an E7 role with almost no guidance as an E5. And the award got kicked back. And my command sergeant major called me and he said, if you're going to put John's award in, you need to wait until he pins E6, because then he'll be a staff sergeant and brigade won't automatically deny the award. And he'll just put in a letter of lateness and get it signed. It'll be fine. He'll get his award. And I was thinking, like, but that's the whole point. He's an E5 operating as an E7. Like, why on earth would I wait until he promotes? And he says, well, no, because that's the way the rules are with Brigade. You can't give Bronze Stars as end-of-tour awards to anyone below the rank of E6 at Brigade. That's the rule. And I was just thinking to myself, but why? What if a soldier's an E4 and fucking does a bang-up job? Well, guess what? I was running a tactical operations center not too long after this at, you know, the provincial headquarters and had an E4 that was doing a great job. Put him in. Nope, no Bronze Star allowed. He got an MSM, which is something good. I'm glad he got an MSM, but fuck, man. Like, the whole idea that you can't give a soldier an award that's commensurate with his performance because he's not senior enough in rank. That's just, it just seems so bizarre. And now, like, go figure, say the solution is, well, let's just create a separate device so that you can be like, no, it's still a Bronze Star. It's just a Bronze Star for, like, RC car operator when you thought it was like he was a NASCAR driver.
Well, you know, I can finally, you know, in Call of Duty, they have a RC car operation that you can drive a little car with a bomb on it to kill people with. So
it's like Daesh is my first IED. Fuck, yeah, man.
Yeah, the award system, the entire award structure is completely fucked when it comes to that. Because one of our officers did catch an ARCOM, and she broke down into tears about it. Now, granted, she was not the best officer. She was kind of one of those people who shouldn't really have, you know, fine in the Army, but really shouldn't have deployed. She did her job. She did fine with it, but she got that ARCOM as well, and I got the ARCOM, and I remember sitting down and just being like, well, fuck everything about the Army right now. Like, I've never had my morale kicked in the balls more than that. And then to read the notes from a colonel that I have never met in my life, say, you know, meritorious service, but not deserving of an MSM. I was like, I don't even know how to deal with you right now. Like, this is just the dumbest thing possible.
I had a similar thing. It wasn't in combat, but when I was deployed to Honduras, I had an award kicked back because I wasn't senior enough to receive it. And I mean, like, the entire command was like, no, we're behind this. Like, this guy, like, deserves this award. But the person who made the ultimate decision at Joint Task Force Bravo said, no, he's a captain. You have to be at least a major or spend at least a year here to get this award. And I mean, like, whatever. It would have been cool to have a Navy Commendation Medal, but like, or a Joint Services Commendation Medal. But like, the fact is, they fuck soldiers over everything. And one of the funnier anecdotes about this, when I was in the Special Forces qualification course, we had a formation one morning because guys who had gone through, like, they were 18 X-ray enlistees, like, they were doing the thing where you enlist off the street to become a Green Beret, and it's like about 2 years of training. They had gone through their equivalent of the basic NCO course of, like, WLC or whatever you call it now, but they have their own special acronym for it in Special Forces. And the guy who placed, like, the honor graduate of that class got an ARCOM for being the honor graduate.
Jesus.
And the like runners up got MS or was it AAMs, Army Achievement Medals. And I remember this guy sitting next to me because he had deployed with 4th ID as a regular infantryman before he went to selection and got selected. He's like, oh, that's great. They got an ARCOM for a course. I got one for a fucking combat deployment. He's just like, Jesus Christ, man. Like, but that's the thing. I mean, you know, like, the SF guys will just hand out awards. I mean, people who have access to the, like, they have the ear of the approver can hand out awards. And it's just, it's one of those things where you find that the Army promises itself to be this totally meritocratic, equal organization. And much like anything that defines itself as being a meritocracy, it's a lie.
Hey, Nate, I've got a Joint Service Commendation Medal.
You motherfucker. Well, I have a Bronze Star, whatever, without a remote control device, because I wasn't actually valorous, but I was there. So they're like, well, you showed up and you had the appropriate rank, so here's your cool award. So.
Yeah, they gave out some weird awards in 2004. I also have one that, like, was only given out during three or four years, like, before they split the Iraq and Afghanistan campaign medals. So I have an Iraq campaign medal, but I don't have an Afghanistan one. But I have one that's like a it's a joint something freedom medal or some shit. I can't even remember. I mean,
I ran a bar in Honduras and raised so much money for this orphanage that we sponsored because my soldiers like drinking so much that I actually received the military outstanding volunteer service medal for it.
That's a thing. So, yeah.
So yes, I managed to parlay the Army's penchant for alcoholism into volunteer service, and I'm not gonna say that's the award I'm most proud of. I think Pathfinder badge is the one I'm most proud of because that's a fucking hard course.
Yeah, that
like,
is.
Like probably more so than Ranger School, because Ranger School in a lot of ways is like a group achievement, but. It is, on one side, it's like, oh, it's cool, we have all these awards. I mean, I want an Antarctica service ribbon, like, that would be cool. But on the other side, it's like, you realize that we've gotten profligate with how we give out ribbons, and it's always hilarious to go back and look at photos from, like, 2003. Like, my old battalion had, like, photos on the share drive of, like, the 2003-2004, like, Expert Infantryman's Badge competition, and the battalion commander, like, the lieutenant colonel in charge of the battalion was handing out awards, and, like, he only had an EIB and, like, two rows of ribbons. Meanwhile, yeah. You've got like a PFC in the Army now who's got like four rows of ribbons who looks like a, you know, looks like a caudillo from Central America. Like, it's just fucking ridiculous.
Yeah, if you ever look at pictures of like Eisenhower in his dress uniform, and it's like two rows of
they
of
used to only give out campaign ribbons, man. Yeah. Like if that were the case, I think I would have the Global War on Terror Expeditionary Medal, and I'd have the Afghan Campaign Medal, and maybe they'd let me wear my Korea Service Medal, but I doubt it.
Yeah.
Like, because it wasn't like it was the Korean War. It was just fucking DMZ duty.
Well, all right, Nate. Well, I think we're hitting that. I think we're hitting that hitting line. That, I got
when Francis has to run to formation, and I have to go be a regular civilian again. So thank you for listening to this ad hoc version of our show, and look forward to more bonus content coming up from especially Adrian Bonnenberger. He's been lining up the great interviews with important thinkers of our time.
Well, Freddie DeBauer, but that,
hey, you're not allowed to make fun of the people who are going to be on our show, Francis.
I can make fun of Freddie. All the other ones I won't, but I'll give Freddie shit all the time. But that's because I'm cool with Freddie. I love him. All right, everybody. So thanks for joining us. Be sure to, if you want to get access to those bonus episodes, go ahead and jump onto the Patreon. Give us $5 a month. And otherwise,
have a good one, everybody.
Soldiers to the war have gone, who may never return again. 10 million mothers' hearts must break for the one who died in vain. Heads bowed down in sorrow in her lonely years, I heard a mother murmur through her tears. I didn't raise my boy to be a soldier. I brought him up to be my pride and joy.
And joy, who dared to place a musket on his shoulder to shoot some other mother's darling boy.
Let nations liberate their future troubles.
It's time to lay the sword and gun away.
There'd be no war today if mothers all would say,
I didn't raise my boy to be a soldier.